Well, thank you for that very warm welcome. And we all know the problem, don't we? We know we can't go on the way we are. We're working to a climax in human affairs which just cannot go on, and that we've got to change. And if we don't change, we're going to go the way we're going. And that's not very nice. I think all of us know about human numbers, about finite resources, about the environment, about climate change, and also about social disintegration and spiritual collapse. And we think we can get by ignoring these things. Most of us do, but I'm hoping that all of you here are not part of that majority. How's that? You know, the last time I came to this festival was a long time ago, and I took a service in a marquee, but I was rather horrified beforehand to discover I hadn't got my prayer book with me. And I went to the local farmer and borrowed his, and he said, "You've heard the news, haven't you?" I said, "No." He said, "Well, Princess Diana was killed this morning in Paris." I said, "Oh, well." And during the service, the intercessions, I said, "I think it might be a good thing if we had special prayers for Princess Diana." And one lady promptly fainted. That's how imposing these events do strike people. But, you know, previous civilizations have collapsed. We're not the first one to go that way, but we're going that way for a quite different reason. We're confronted today with new forms of power. And you know, it's incredible, but people are politically, how can one put it, rudimentary in the way they're looking at the scene, as though they're still looking at the politics of let's say 200 years ago, when all the decisions were taken by parliaments, and monarchs, and bishops, and all sorts of big people, and we followed where they went. But it's not like that anymore. Somebody said only the other day to me that the boardrooms are now no longer having to weigh in with the government, because now they are the government. And let's take that on board, because that is the crucial factor confronting us in decision-making terms today, that we are no longer able to control our destinies. We're no longer able to make significant decisions. All these decisions are being made by the boardroom boys of one kind or another, up and down the country, in one kind of enterprise or another. Just think for a moment of the way in which the power to make decisions is now in the hands of those who run the supermarkets, those who run the utilities, those who run the airlines, the transport, the energy. Whatever way you look today, we're not deciding anything. We are being got at. And we're being got at by one significant factor, which is dominating the scene today, And that is the power of advertising. How much money is spent every month on advertising? How many millions of pounds are spent on invading public consciousness with one single message? Buy, consume. And it's an invasion of public consciousness so enormous that it's swamping every other aspect of our lives. And we still think that somewhere along the line that if we don't like something, all we've got to do is to vote for another member of parliament or campaign for another kind of cause, and perhaps all will be well. What we don't realize is that we're no longer having any effect on the scene, none. What we're confronted with is a situation where the boardroom boys have taken over and they are deciding which way we are going. And we are going in terms of lack of decision-making power in our own hands. And what this means is that, you see, all these technologies and these new means of communication and so on, they've had this effect that instead of us using different kinds of economic activity to influence our situation, that situation is being used to influence us. And we're seeing it very clearly in things like television and mass newspapers. Whereas previously, you know, they were forms of power, communication, which was very much in our hands. In villages, in small urban parishes, we were running the show, and we're no longer doing it. You know, I was reared in Hornchurch in an orphanage that was built in Victorian times by the Board of Guardians of the parish of St. Leonard's in Shoreditch. That Board of Guardians no longer exists. That parish no longer exists as a significant political factor. What does exist are giant government structures run by bureaucrats telling us what to do. And, you know, the upshot is that instead of us running the show, we are being the victims of what other people are deciding. We are being lulled into a compliance and an acquiescence of what's going on about consumerism, which we have not decided at all. It's being decided by other people with completely different motives, different interests altogether. Look, there were years when generations, when our trade, our shopping was done by local people in local shops owned by local families. And we were communicating. A local shop, we were socially significant people. We were vibrant and alive. We were relating to our neighbors, to our friends, perhaps even our enemies. But still, we were relating. We were in communication. Today, we go into a supermarket and we're strangers. We're strangers among strangers. And we're no longer communicating with people significantly. We're being got at all the time. Again, we are not exercising power. we're being victims of power, and we have to ask ourselves just what it is we can do. All that money spent on advertising is not spent for nothing. It's spent in order to persuade us to do something, to be something, to go somewhere that we have not chosen ourselves to do. Well, let's see where we're going. We're verging now on a state of moral bankruptcy, and we're forgetting something. We're forgetting that morality depends on communication. I think it was Gandhi who said that you can't have morality without community. And what we're witnessing today is where the community factor is being pushed aside, and we are being herded into something quite new in human history, which is the mass form of society. And the significant thing about the mass is that instead of us controlling it, it is controlling us. Whereas in the past, even in authoritarian forms of communication, of government, we were still able to exercise significant levels of influence over our lives and over our shopping, over our communication, and whatever it else we were doing, our entertainment, our amusement, and so on. Today, we're now on the receiving end and driven far away. And you know, you have to ask yourself, what went wrong with all those young people in the streets of the big cities? They were showing, I think, what they think of modern life. It's true that others jumped on the bandwagon who saw a chance of getting something. But basically, I think these people were saying they didn't like where the way we were going. They wanted something different. Well, we need to help them to find something different, something that's worthwhile, something that's fulfilling and meaningful. You know, there's a tide in the affairs of men which, taken at the flood, leads on to fortune, and omitted, all the voyage of their life is bound in shallows and in miseries. And on such a full sea are we now afloat, and we must take the current as it serves or lose our ventures. So with your will, go on and only have courage. Have courage to realize that it's the courage in your heart on which all things depend. It's the courage of life alone that keeps sky and earth apart. And if that courage fail, if that sacred fire go out, then all things fail and all things go out, and we mustn't let it happen. We owe it to our heritage, we owe it to those who come after us, those who follow us, we owe it to them to do something that's worthwhile, significant, in where we are today, if we're going to go anywhere. Modern life is significant because of the way it's destroying communication and the way forward is the way back. The way back to make things smaller, not bigger. Make them smaller so that we have an influence on what's happening in them. Don't take any notice of this European exercise. Again, it's coming from the boardroom boys. They want it, and it's not popular, and they are doing their best to impose their lifestyle on us so that the old order, where Christian values were at one time the dominant force in modern society, in society, have now become a marginal force as the forces of the market have taken over. And somewhere along the line, we have got to organize ourselves and form ourselves into situations where we can force our way back to running the show ourselves rather than depending on others. So the new order that I see it is one which is going to depend on local community power. We've got to learn to have a completely new sacred view of local community power, as the community is where, when Jesus said love your neighbor, he meant you had a neighbor. You know, he didn't say love Marks and Spencers. And what we're finding now is that without the sense of neighborhood, without the sense of relationship with people, we are of no significance whatsoever. I don't know why, but as I talk to you, I'm remembering the story I was telling somebody today of the priest who gave a lift in his car, and the chap got on board chewing sandwiches, and as they went along, he explained that he was a professional pickpocket, and every time he got out of prison, he no sooner got out than he did it again and went back in. And as they went along, they were stopped by the police for speeding, and the policeman put it all down and said, well, you'll be hearing more about this, and off they went. And when they got to their destination, the chap said, well, you can drop me here. And he said, I've left a little present for you on the back seat. And the priest said, oh, you've no need to leave anything for me like that. He said, well, you know, I just want you to know how grateful I am for your help and your kindness. And when the priest got home, he opened the packet and he found it was the policeman's notebook. And at least, you know, something was happening where people were making decisions rather than just being victims all the time. And what we are seeing, you know, we need to take this on board too, that what is happening in the world is a gigantic change of consciousness at every level in every part of the world. There is no part of the world today which is not influenced and affected by a new awareness of human dignity, of human status, and human destiny. And that awareness is gradually sweeping the world. And what it means is that that change is going to determine the politics of tomorrow. It's not going to be Europe or any big party or anything. It's going to be everywhere, small parties in local communities everywhere, saying, we want this, we're going to decide this, we're going to do this. We've got to learn to realize that there's something abominable about having a ministry of education at all. What a ministry of education is doing is saying that, you know, the parents in your community don't know how to educate their children. Well, who says they're not? Let them get on with it. Let them get on with it and do it their way, even if they make mistakes. They can learn from mistakes. They can't learn from yours, and do it in that way. But bear in mind that what we're looking at the world at the same time is an absolute transformation of the tribal situation in every country. You know, it's incredible when you think about it, but people in the past, Europeans got hold of the guns. They were the first ones to have the guns. So they went to India, to Africa, to Asia, and established empires. Why? What right have they? Now these people have got the guns too. So up and down the world, what we're seeing is a transformation of the political structure of society where the small tribes, the small communities are emerging to take over from the big centralized forces that are at present dominating or presuming to dominate the world. And this new colonialism that has spread across the world, it's not going to prove any more durable than the past forms of colonialism. We're seeing it even in England. Aren't we hearing talk about Welsh nationalism, Scottish nationalism, Cornish nationalism? And in the United States, on my computer, I get messages from different states who are talking about secession from the United States. They don't want a United States. They want a disunited States. And the whole idea is that behind it is that we shall have organic structures of society where we are relating to each other and in significant ways that enables us to take over. Well, all this activity that we're looking at around the world is going on, and it's creating a world, not of world unity. Wasn't it Tennyson who said that far along the world wide whisper of the south wind rushing warm, with the banners of the people plunging through the thunderstorm, till the war drums beat no longer and the battle flags were furled, in the parliament of man, the federation of the world. It was a Victorian dream that has dominated human life. What has got to take over from that dream, if it's not to become an increasing nightmare, is a dream of human fulfillment, human destiny, and human decision-making. Let's do it. And we have plenty of examples to show that we're not plunging, as it were, into the unknown. You know, if you stop to think about it, all the really stable, well-to-do, and free societies in the world today are small. Strange, isn't it? Think of the Scandinavians. Think of the Baltic states. Think of, if you like, of Switzerland. Just think for a moment of Switzerland. Switzerland is not a federation, it's a confederation of different groups of cantons who are agreeing to work together on certain matters, but otherwise, thanks very much, we're running our own show. And Switzerland is a country of four nationalities, four languages, four religions, four cultures, and in the heart of Europe, it's been one of complete peace. In the midst of war-torn Europe, it has maintained for 200 years the peace. Haven't we a lesson to learn from that? Let's take on board the lesson that is there for us and adopt it. And I think there is something about Switzerland which we have to hold in our minds as the way we are going. And but let me add this too. I don't think anything would change without the passion of religious conviction to push us forward. That the idea that, you know, adult people still can look at the phenomena of life, of the mysteries of space, of time, of the complexity of natural life of every kind, and the enormity of the planetary system that we are part of, and think that there is not an intention behind it. Adult people believe that, millions of them, that there's nothing in it, that we can go along as though it's all going to be okay If we ignore the ultimate questions of life, and if we just simply enjoy ourselves as much as we can, it's the quickest way, perhaps, to make for a nightmare. But, you know, this consensus, this global consensus, which is emerging all over the world, for people to have their own say in how they live and want their lives to be lived in terms of some kind of moral decency that replaces the market forces which are now dominating us, is what is the way forward that is going to dominate the politics of tomorrow. Can we do that? Can we? Have we got the courage to do it? Because if we have, we'll win. And let's not make any mistake about it. We can win and we will win. Thanks.
Very much. We're now going to have an opportunity to ask some questions and have a discussion. We have a roving microphone, so let's see if there are any anything has sprung to mind here.
I just wondered whether it was you quoted Switzerland. Switzerland is a very rich country, as are the Scandinavian countries. Is it possible to have moral stability without economic prosperity?
Is it possible to have
moral stability without economic prosperity?
Well, it's almost a condition of it, isn't it? the idea that morality is dependent upon prosperity is really turning the thing upside down, isn't it? What we're really saying is that we want stability to depend on morality.
There's another question on this side.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Something that came to my mind is quite sort of discouraging at the beginning. You were saying that we are controlled by big business. We're not idiots, we're still in control. It's sort of price and demand. You're trying to tell me that big business sort of forces me to buy electronic goods and whatever. I still have that choice. We still all have an individual choice to make, don't we? Do you understand where I'm coming from? We're not robots. We're not sort of big business shouldn't force us to buy what they have to sell us. We should have those choices.
Well, you know, this is assuming that the power of advertising has no influence whatsoever, and it's assuming that we can, as it were, make our own decisions. In a context where the force of advertising is so enormous that it's dominating the scene. You know, the power of a modern television station today is far greater than any parliament in determining where people are going, what they're doing. And when you say that we still have the power, you're saying it within a context where you're not aware perhaps of the extent to which your pattern, your lifestyle, has been determined already for you. That, for example, when was there a moral debate about motor cars? Why not? When was there a moral debate about supermarkets? and the way they've superseded local family shops all over the place. What's happening there is, of course, that we assume that they're part of the natural order, that we can accept them and use them without realizing that, in fact, what they are doing is dominating our entire lifestyle in a way which makes it impossible for us to have a significant influence.
Hi, Keith. I was in Bradford for a couple of weeks recently, and I was taken around some of the mills, the abandoned mills, and there's square acres of the city centre that are completely abandoned. And it started me wondering about what the future of cities is. I wonder if you could comment on that.
Which city was this?
Bradford. Bradford.
Bradford,
up north.
Bradford, oh, yeah. Sorry. Well, I don't think that the modern context of a city lifestyle can continue. I think there's something essentially transient about the nature of modern city life. It's far too big, it's far too complex, and it's far too dependent on vast reserves of finite resources, which in the nature of things, since they are finite, will give out. There's never been any moral debate about the use of oil, has there? All the debate has been about whether we can use it or not, and whether it's good for us.
Right. Question in the middle.
If I'm getting you right, you're arguing that the way to solve our problems would be to take power away from big business and institutions. In practice, how do you think this would be possible to achieve? Can we abolish the EU? Can we abolish Marks and Spencer? Can we abolish the Church of England?
Good. Well, you know, I started in my own village, a village newspaper, somewhere around here. And I've tried to relate modern global trends and crisis factors. Here we go. And to, at the same time, to relate it to what's happening in the village itself. And, you know, it seems to me that this is something which must happen everywhere, that every centre of people must have its own voice for saying what it thinks about the fundamental questions of modern life, not just the trivial things or the marginal things that are on the side of things. I find this is one of the things wrong with religion, organized religion, that it seems so bent on organizing worship routines that it seems to have lost sight of what the purpose of those routines is, which is to change life, not to accept it. How's that?
Hi. I suppose free market ideology and kind of.
Can I, do you want to stand up? And then
sorry.
It's a voice from the audience. It's harder for John to see where you are. Great, thanks.
Free market ideology kind of so dominates political debate now, and there don't seem to be any more reformist organisations, left wing organisations, don't really seem to exist in Britain or America and much of Europe. And I wondered, like, how do you think this came to be? That everyone believed in, you know, a free market and big business. And how do you think that will change?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear this. Are you saying that big business?
I mean, if you look at this, the political debate going on in society, everyone, the banking crisis, for example, none of the solutions to that were to reform the banking system or regulations. There don't seem to be any mass organisations or political organisations that represent reformist ideas. And how, I mean, we're all talking about the problems in society, but I mean, how do we go about changing that? How do we go about forming organisations that kind of stand for a change in society?
What we're confronted with in the money world is the fact that banks must lend, because if they don't lend, they go down. They go down to their competitors. But in following this imperative to lend, they're simply expanding the world debt. And I think in today's Times, there was an article, the effect that there's no way in which the modern world economic system can possibly pay the debts that have accumulated, that ultimately there's going to be a default in the money system and a collapse of money values.
John, we've asked people to come to the front now.
Hello. I'm very interested that you are so dismissive of politics at a national and European level. The government, as you probably know, is introducing the localism bill, which will allow people to take control at a local level and produce their own neighbourhood plans for what they want in their community. It's also potentially a very dangerous bill, because it involves a lot of deregulation, particularly of the planning system, which allows a great opportunity for people like Tesco and others to influence those neighbourhood plans. So I think it's really important we do have strong political national structures. And you were particularly scathing of the European level and saying how it's not popular, but actually some of the strongest environmental laws have come from the European Union, which our government have run miles from in terms of trying to implement. So don't you think there is value in strong political institutions?
Good. Well, okay. But bear in mind that the whole European exercise is a boardroom exercise which has been created by people for boardroom interests, regardless of anything else. And if other factors can be brought in, let's say relating to the environment, that can sustain the European exercise without infringing on the essential purpose of the European exercise, which is to dominate the European economic system, then they'll do it. But that's all. The fact remains that the overwhelming purpose of the European exercise is to dominate European economic life, and we're already seeing how, in terms of the monetary system in Europe, it is falling apart and can't possibly continue. Would you agree with that?
I totally agree with you that we need to challenge the powerful, but my question is that the powerful and the people in control at the moment have policemen, they have jails, they have guns and tear gas. How can we small people without any of that stand up to them?
Because we've got moral force, and ultimately it's ideas and moral force which prevails in human society. There's something essentially transient about this phenomena of guns and economic power and the rest of it, which can't possibly continue. What we're having to face is that it's going to collapse. And is it going to collapse into some ugly form of authoritarianism, such as prevailed in Germany in the 1930s and 40s? Or is it going to be some kind of blossoming of human political purpose on new levels of understanding and new levels of creativity and new levels of fulfillment? I think that we have the chance to do that. I don't think that the powers that prevail at the moment can possibly prevail without either going up very much or going down very much. And I think that, you know, our purpose needs to be to make it go up and forward rather than back and down.
Hello. Thank you for sharing what you shared with us. And it seems that you're making an incredibly impassioned case for localism. And I wondered what you thought the importance of getting involved in a local political party has for this movement that you want to engender. Is that part of it, or would you say we need to find a way outside the political parties to do these kind of things?
I think we've got to find a completely new political approach to our problems. You know, I was a member of a political party, I've been a member of the Labour Party, I've been a member of the Green Party, and I've been a member of the Independence Party. But my feeling is that these parties tend to be dominated by the centralised bureaucracies that operate them. They in fact become part of the problem rather than the solution. And that the answer really is for us to insist that the power is where we are within our own relationships, in our own neighbourhoods, and to build it up from there. I think this can be done. I think other countries have shown how this can be done, and there's no reason at all why we shouldn't have a go too.
That was a very challenging and informative talk. Thank you. I'd like to go back to Europe. When England plays France at rugby in a month's time, I hope we stuff the French. But the French and the Brits are now cooperating over an aircraft carrier. When Greece gets into economic difficulties today, Merkel stakes her German political capital in order to bail them out. 70 years ago, German boots were marching through Athens, and the Athenian population were reduced to eating mice because there was nothing else for them to do. The EU is grossly inefficient, it is corrupt, but it is cheaper to pay me to go to Germany and drink beer in the name of research than to go there and shoot them. The European Union has transformed the political landscape, and it's made French, Germans, Dutch, Norwegians, Danes into friends and allies rather than the enemies that they were during two world conflicts in the 20th century. So I'm disappointed to hear you diss that European Union experiment and sacrifice it on the altar of economics when the real vision is a political one and a social one, not purely a monetary one.
I'm not sure that I call together agree. I'm not sure that we are taking on board the full implications of the European exercise and where it's going, what it's trying to do. But I think that in the end, we mustn't decide our economic systems in terms of where we find the beer cheapest, or was it? I think we've got to see that we need first a stable economic system, and one that's much, much more simpler than what we're now developing. One that is, so complex and so enormous that it's inevitably going to collapse in one way or another as time goes on. But having said that, I think that we have to see that the thing is very much a unity of both politics and economics in the way it's going, that you can't separate one or the other from them.
Hi, I'm slightly disturbed by our friend here's reaction that he feels that the only way we can do anything about corporate power is something that needs to be responded to with rubber bullets and tear gas. If we think of some of the problems that have faced the world in the 20th century, the hole in the ozone layer, for instance, and acid rain, Solutions to that have been peaceful, and they have involved ordinary people standing up and making their opinions known. And basically what it takes to take back the power from the corporations is for all of us to stand up and shout louder than these corporations that are subverting the political processes. For instance, it's true that the corporations have an undue influence on our politicians. Classic understatement, I realise. But also these politicians depend on us to actually go and make our mark on the ballot papers. So if we start standing up and saying, well, what are you doing about global warming? What are you doing about supermarkets? What are you doing about Coca-Cola making people homeless and drying up wells in Kerala in India? Then that's going to get their attention. That's going to get them nervous. You know, one way that we can make our voices heard is to get over to the G-Source tent and see what groups are actually getting together to apply that pressure to the politicians, and make our voices heard, and not simply accept that power has been taken away.
I'm not sure that I understand fully the point you're making there, but it seems to me that we have to accept that if we try to organize on a mass scale, like mass parties do, we simply become part of the problem. We cease to be part of the solution. This was my experience in all the political activity that I'm involved in. But it does seem to me that it's got to be based on our local communities, wherever we are, whatever we are, that we in our local communities are saying, we decide what to do and work out how to make what we decide operate. It's not an easy task. I fully accept this. I'm really begging all the questions in a sense. But nevertheless, the fact remains that there's no other way forward, none whatsoever.
Hello. You talked a bit about the banking defaults, and it's quite interesting talking about the free market economy, where it seems that the whole quantitative easing exercise has been about moving the debt from the corporate sector into the public sector. So it's no longer business debt, it's now our debt. And there is a minority growing momentum suggesting that there is going to be international default on debt, starting with the collapse of the dollar and what's going on in Europe. And my question would be is, and you've kind of acknowledged that default is coming, what do you think life will look like during that default and that deflation, and what can we practically do about that on a local level now to kind of prepare for that or manage that in our communities?
Well, take the last part of the question first. What are we able to do? I think we've got to focus on the need to produce our own local food as much as possible and stop depending on vast networks of transport to produce it bring it to us. In my village, we have about 8 dairy farms in the vicinity, but all the milk from those dairy farms is taken to Cadbury's chocolate factory in London, and our milk comes from Bath and Cirencester, where this is the sort of madhouse that modern life has created, and which I think we have got to see that there's a sort of sense of fulfillment in producing our own food. You know, only yesterday, on the news, there was an information that in a few years, something like 40% of the people in Britain are going to be obese. How many of us are obese already? And when you look at it, it's simply because our shops are absolutely full of food which is dead, which has no vitality and doesn't impart vitality to the human system. And life is dependent on life to flourish at all. And once we break that chain, then every conceivable kind of illness is going to supervene. But, you know, further than that, we've got to see that there's something essential about political power being related to the way we produce our local food and things connected with it, and that somehow or other we have to ensure that our food is, well, can we just say decent, and which it isn't at the moment. Ensure it's decent, and we can only do that by ensuring it's decent on a local level.
John, thank you very much, and everyone here, thank you for coming along to this discussion, taking part in it.